he should work.
Why don't you just turn him into pork lo mein and feed him to Mr. Wu?
The spell is only temporary, and it's perfectly safe.
Come on, Toby, we have to find out what's attracting the dogs. We're only human. Dogs have a heightened sense of smell and hearing. If you change into a dog, you may be able to lead us to the recipe.
Think of it as hands-on Shaolin training.
Oh, yeah, let Toby do the dirty work. That's all he's good for.
Fine, if you're too scared.
Right. Like I'm falling for that one.
Sid.
I'm not a chicken!
Okay. All right, so I think we kind of started. All right, can you hear me?
What?
No.
Testing. Oh. Testing.
There it is. There it is. Going deaf.
Right, yeah. Forgot. Some furry cons still kind of don't have breaks between panels. If you come to my con history panel and talk about that tomorrow. But for this panel, this is the shapeshifters and transformation in fiction panel. Who here has been to any of my panels in the past before? Okay, cool. So because we have a shorter amount of time because there's I want to get out early to make sure that the next panelists are able to sell up as well. We're going to probably do a little shorter version of this panel. If you want the full version of the panel, I think an hour and a half version is on my YouTube channel at Transformartive. That includes a big range of the history panel. For this one, I'm going to try to do a mix between the classical shape-shifting stuff and the newer shape-shifting stuff. So let's just quickly begin. So you guys might know me as Transformartive. That's my Twitter handle. That's my YouTube channel. I do a lot of TF stuff. If you saw my booth in the dealer's den, I'm the one with all the flags. I work on some TF web comics. I'm also working on my own new series now called Shapeshifter School. So I'm doing a Shapeshifter room party. It's going to be at 8 p.m. tonight in room 1467. And tomorrow at 9 p.m., so come by and check that out. So some of the clips that I will be playing, I'll be playing in this panel. I'll have a TV running with a bunch of those clips. As well, we'll have TF potion drinks and stuff. And just it's just going to be a fun place for fellow TF fans to just kind of meet up and chat and get to know each other. All right. So, I normally do this panel when I have a little bit more time. I divide it into three periods, kind of the historical side of transformation. So transformation as it appears in some of our oldest mythology, shamanism, and religious traditions. And then transformation as it appears in modern fiction and media. And then if I have a little bit more time, we'll get into a bit of the tropes. But I'm going to try to do a kind of a summary of this panel, and then I'm going to try to leave time towards the end for questions and answers. So yeah, I'm working on my Shapeshifter School series, so be sure to check that out. Hopefully I'll have it done in time for FWA, so keep an eye out for that. So most transformation stories that we kind of see, especially in the ancient times, fall under the curse category. In the more modern period, we have transformation fall under the power fantasy trope. And then, especially with the furry fandom and Therians, we have a transformation as a form of escapism. So these are going to kind of be the three classic categories we see most transformation fiction fall under. So we start with the shamans. Since we have a little bit of time, I'm going to just go straight into the TF characters. So let's start with the first one, the fox spirits. So fox spirits are going to be the East Asian, I guess, the niche, every single region we're going to look at around the world, so the Americas, Europe, Africa, and Asia, each of them are going to have one dominant shapeshifter kind of view that specific niche. So we're going to see that with the werewolves in Europe, we're going to see that with the werehyenas in Africa, we're going to see that with the different jaguar and puma shapeshifters in the Americas, but in East Asia specifically, we see the fox spirits. The fox spirits actually come from the Chinese Huli Jins, which are the traditional nine-tailed foxes. And actually, unlike most weird creatures we're going to see later on, where it's a human turning into an animal, this is kind of the reverse, where we have an animal turning into a human. Specifically, most of these fox spirits fall under a category that we call yokai, which is translates to strange ghosts. It's also where the term yokai comes from when we go over to Japan. But specifically, these are animals, sometimes both animals and inanimate objects, that basically absorb life force, energy, and chi, and are able to transform and disguise themselves as humans. And we see this with the Huli Jin in China, and as we go prey on human flesh. And actually, while the Tiefelongs specifically are trying to lead humans astray, they actually aren't that bad. They don't directly kill anybody. They just make you get lost and kind of try and lead you astray. Now, if we want to talk about the more dangerous sort of shapeshifters, this is when we go to the Celtic Isles and we see the Kelpies. The Kelpies are interesting because they are also start off as animal in their animal form, sometimes as anthropomorphic horses, sometimes as sea monsters, but they always take the form of either a white or black horse on land. Sometimes they could take the form of a male or female human. But most times when they're in the form of a horse, if you touch them, you automatically get stuck on them and they drag you into the water and drown you. They normally have vicious teeth, sharp teeth, and pull you apart. Now, what's interesting is we associate silver bullets as being a weakness to werewolves now, and as we see with a lot of ancient traditions, silver is actually not a weakness to werewolves up until the modern period. However, silver is a weakness to the Kelpies, so you can actually control a Kelpie if you put a silver bridle on them. Now, in Africa, we have the were-hyena tradition. Often called the Budai. The Buddha is a were-hyena that I'm not sure if it evolved across the African continent or if it evolved independently across different areas in Africa, because Africa is the biggest continent we have. So there's a lot of different versions of the were-hyenas that evolved. And actually in the Middle East as well, we have different variations of the were-hyenas. Most of the times, the were-hyenas are associated with blacksmiths, which is very interesting. So we see this happen in Ethiopia, Tanzania, Morocco. Were-hyenas are associated with being blacksmiths. Now in Ethiopia is also interesting because most of the Jewish Ethiopians are also blacksmiths. So there's association with Jewish Ethiopians also being were-hyenas. However, that does fall into some anti-Semitic tropes because Ethiopian Christians will then accuse Jewish families of being were-hyenas. So it's very interesting when we see that. What's interesting about this is there is different variations of the were-hyenas, and they take on a more anthropomorphic hyena form. Sometimes they look like giant hyenas, sometimes they look like half-human, half-animal hyenas. One variation that we have in Somalia, where we talk about, again, the vampiric shamans again, there is a version of the were-hyena that they rub themselves with a wooden staff, and that is the transformation trigger that causes them to turn to a hyena, and they have to rub themselves back to turn into a human again. So there's different variations of this. Now, when we go to the different types of transformation, we also have the skin-shedding transformation, which appears all across the world as well. Most commonly, we have skin-shedding as the main form of transformation in a lot of Northern European and Scandinavian cultures. Specifically, we have the berserkers and the silky, but we also have a lot of bird transformation stories. And what's interesting is a lot of these bird transformation stories often involve a human male tricking a bird shapeshifter by stealing her feathers, forcing her to take on a female human form, and forcing her into marriage. Now, we see this in Europe, and it's called the Swan Maiden Myth. In fact, we see this so many times pop up in fairy tales. There's just so many different Swan Maiden myths from Ireland all the way to Russia. Now, what surprisingly is in Japan, you have almost the exact same version. It's called the Crane Wife tale, and that pops up again and again in Japan. And then when you go all the way to the Inuit traditions in North America, you have Inuit traditions where it involves a goose lady who gets transformed into a woman, almost the exact same story. And what's interesting is these involve all independently of each other, and they are always normally aquatic bird who are white. So I always find that as kind of something that's interesting. But the most famous of the skin-shedding transformations we have are the berserkers. These come from the Norse, Viking, and Scandinavian traditions. Most of them evolved from the Celtic Germanic traditions during the Roman period. And these normally involve warriors who could put on bear skins and basically have the strength of the bear, and depending on some traditions, actually turn into a full bear. Now, you have to notice that it's not that the skin is a transformation enchanted object that causes the transformation. The skin is actually a part of their body. It's not a separate talisman or totem that is needed for transformation. The skin is just part of them, and when they take off the skin, that's when they turn into a human form. So the berserkers are the most famous example we have of this. We see this all throughout different Celtic and Norse traditions in Europe. And surprisingly enough, in ancient Germanic tribes, we also have a wolf version of this called the wolf cult, and we also have a wild boar version of this. So it's interesting because we have Roman werewolves and Greek werewolves developing around the same time as we have this skin-shedding version of the Germanic werewolf. So if there's any writers out there who want to do a story of Roman werewolves versus Germanic werewolves, this might be an interesting idea to look into. The other most famous example we have also comes from some Celtic traditions, and this is where we actually have the Silkies. Silkies, a very, very similar tradition as with the berserkers, but also very, very similar with the bird transformation stories we have. Oftentimes we have silky stories of silky come on land in seal form, shed their seal skin, reveal themselves to be a beautiful maiden. They have their seal skin stolen by a human male, forced into marriage. Exact same story over again. You see this lot of variation of the story over and over again. Sometimes it's foxes, but oftentimes it's the silky. And normally in the silky tradition, she will find her seal skin and instantly put it on and turn back into a seal. In some traditions, if the silky and the human male had kids, then all the kids will also turn to seals and follow the mother back to the ocean. Now, werewolves are obviously going to be the most famous example that we have when it comes to these types of traditions. And we can look at werewolves as some of the oldest transformation stories that we have. So the earliest version of a human-to-wolf transformation comes from the Epic of Gilgamesh. But the most famous example, and probably what popularized a lot of the wolf transformation stories in ancient mythology and religious traditions, came from King Lycaon, the king of Arcadia. He was transformed into a wolf by Zeus for feeding him human flesh. And in this version of the story, the festival, which was meant to honor Zeus, called the Festival of Lycia, he basically killed and sacrificed one of his sons and served it as a meat for the festival. So anyone who partook in eating human flesh during that festival basically became a wolf. And some variations of the story, if these humans transformed to wolves abstained from eating any human flesh for 9 years, they would be able to turn back into a human form. So this is a transformation where you were basically stuck in wolf form, but you could turn back into a human if you abstained from cannibalism. But he's going to kind of be the prototype for all the different werewolf traditions that we see, especially when Greek stories go over to ancient Rome. Now, in Rome, we have a variation of Roman shapeshifters. These are called the Varisvelli. And one of the more famous versions is we have a centurion in the Roman army who witnesses one of his fellow soldiers stripping naked at night, turning to a wolf and running away to the woods. So this is something that was kind of ingrained with Greco-Roman traditions as well. And in Ireland, we have a lot of different versions of the werewolf as well. If you saw Wolf Walkers, the movie that came out a few years ago, they had different variations of different werewolf transformations. So in ancient pre-Christian Ireland, you had a lot of stories of basically similar to the berserkers, where warriors could wear wolf skins and turn to wolf warriors. In fact, one of the kingdoms in Ireland were believed to be founded by one of these wolf shapeshifters. Now, when Christianity came to the came to Ireland, you have a lot of versions and contextualizing these wolf shapeshifters as those who were cursed by God for howling at Saint Patrick, who was trying to proselytize to them. In fact, it was believed that werewolves were so common during this period that in one of the older texts about Ireland made by Gerard of Wales called Geography of Ireland in the 12th century, he talks about how a priest encounters a dying wolf, and the wolf reveals that he was a human that was cursed to be in the wolf form. He brings the priest to his wife. His wife is also in wolf form, and it kind of goes into the debate of whether a wolf can be given last rites since the wolf is human. In fact, this was something that was actually talked about by some theologians for 100 years. St. Augustine basically talked about